Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. Wonderful to be with you. And today I would like to share with you a tribute to Rabbi Beryl Wine. Rabbi Wine was my Rebbe. He passed away this past Shabbos. And obviously it's a great tragedy and sadness for the Jewish world, for his many hundreds and thousands of Talmidim around the world, and for the Jewish world in general. And so with our short time together, I would like to try and pay a tribute to Rabbi Wine, who was a very great man and had a tremendous influence on Klal Yisrael, on the Jewish people. So we'll divide it up into three parts. We'll first paint a portrait of Rabbi Wine and his life, just to give our listeners a perspective of who he was and where he came from. And then I will share some personal reflections of my relationship with Rabbi Wine. And finally, we'll end with Rabbi Wine's unique perspective. So it's going to be the three P's: a portrait, personal reflections, and perspective. Rabbi Wine was born in 1934 in Chicago. And you might wonder, how did he end up in Chicago? So I'd like to go on a little bit of a journey to tell you about his mother and his father and how they landed up being in Chicago. And the reason why I want to do that is just to give us, it gives us a very valuable understanding of where he came from and the authenticity of his Mesorah. Mesorah in Hebrew is tradition within Judaism and within the Torah world. So one's receiving the Mesorah, receiving the tradition from one's parents and one's teachers, is a very significant part of our life as a Jew and very much puts us into the correct trajectory in our lives. So I think it is valuable to see what kind of rich Torah stock Rabbi Wine came from. Rabbi Wine's father was born in Lithuania, and he went to the prestigious Grodno Yeshiva. Rabbi Wine's father's name was Rabbi Zev Wine, and he was a Talmud of Rabbi Shimon Shkop. Rabbi Shimon Shkop was one of the Rosh Yeshivas of Tells, and then he went on to open his own yeshiva in a place called Grodno in Lithuania. And in 1928, Rabbi Shimon was one of the great rabbis of the generation, a very powerful speaker, a very large man who was dignified and had a great impact on those that he was exposed to. He went to America in 1928 to raise money for his yeshiva, which was, you know, common in the beginning of the 20th century. It was a very common thing for Lithuanian Jews to raise money for the community from Jews in America. He actually spoke at Ritz, which is the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, which is the base midrash of YU, of Yeshiva University, and they asked him to be the Rosh Yeshiva of Ritz, which he accepted. He then went back to Lithuania in 1929, and he told his Talmidim, amongst them Rabbi Wine's father, Rabbi Zev Wine, that the future of the Jewish people in Europe is over, that it's the end for Jews in Europe, and the Jewish world would now be built in the United States and in Eretz Yisrael, which was quite a radical thing to say in the first part of the 20th century, but it was almost prophetic that he could see where things were going for the Jews in Europe. And he therefore encouraged his Talmidim to go to either Eretz Yisrael or to go to the United States. And he pushed his Talmid, Rabbi Zev Wine, to go to America. And he did so. He went to America, Rabbi Zev Wine, and he went to Torah Vadas in New York. And there actually was a competition in the yeshiva. A very wealthy Jew by the name of Rokeach, if I'm not mistaken, offered a prize to the best Talmid, the best student in Torah Vadas, and he said he'd give $500 to the winning student. which in those days, today $500 is a lot of money. Imagine how much it was 100 years ago. And so Rabbi Wan's father won that competition. Rabbi Wan's father was photographic. He was a complete genius, just like Rabbi Wan, and he won that competition. We'll continue when we're back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
So we continue to focus on the sages, but not only the sages of the past, but even present-day sages. And we're talking about my Rebbe, Rabbi Beryl Wind, who passed away on Shabbos. We're discussing where he came from and the background of his life, the portrait of his existence. And his father was a great Talmid Chacham who came to America from Lithuania, encouraged by his Rebbe, Rabbi Shimon Shkop. And he won the prize in Yeshiva Torah Vadas of being the best Bocher, because they obviously set up a curriculum and a test, and he wrote the test, and he won the $500. Rabbi Wan was a phenomenal genius. He just remembered everything. It was quite unbelievable how much he knew and how eloquently he shared it. His father, too, was a very brilliant man, was photographic. Actually, in the yeshiva in Grodno, Rav Shimon Shkop's yeshiva, they didn't have a complete set of shas. It's hard for us to believe today because, you know, everybody has a shas, which is the full Talmud in our homes. Even in the yeshiva, the great Grodno yeshiva, didn't have a full shas. There were a few masechtas missing. There was one person in the town who had a shas. He was a very wealthy man, kept it under lock and key for good reason. And so what they did is they sent selected students to this person's house to go and memorize masechtas, the ones that were missing. And then if anybody needed to know what that masechta said, so one of the Talmi, one of the Bochrim, would be able to tell them exactly what it was. Every page you would be verbatim be able to quote it. Rabbi Wan's father was sent to memorize Chulin. And so he knew all of Chulin, the whole of Masechtas Chulin Baal Peh, which is really a phenomenal achievement, quite unbelievable. Okay, so he then won the competition. He had $500, which was a significant amount of money. And he was ready to get married and to find a marriage partner. There were not many well-known Orthodox Jews who came from the rich heritage of the great yeshivas in Lita. He was told that there was a great rabbi in Chicago by the name of Rabbi Chaim Tzvi Rubinstein, who had three daughters, and he said, he was told, go there, maybe you would like one of the daughters. And so he did so, and that's where he met his wife, Rabbi Wine's mother. They were married, and his father-in-law found him a job to be a rabbi in the shul in Chicago, which he was for over 40 years. So how did Rabbi Wine's grandfather, his mother's father, end up in Chicago? Also, a fascinating story which gives us a good picture as to where he came from. So his grandfather's name was Rabbi Chaim C. Rubinstein. He was a Talmid of the great Volozhin Yeshiva. He got smicha from the Netziv Rav Naftali Tzvi Berlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was also the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. And in 1892, the Netziv decided to close the yeshiva because they were forced to change their curriculum. They weren't able to teach much Torah. Netziv said, under these conditions, which were imposed by the anti-Semitic Russian authorities, it's impossible to continue. They got away with it in the early years when the Russian authorities demanded of them to teach Russian subjects, to teach Russian history. And so they had a separate building in which they taught those subjects, and only like a very small amount of students would go there. But then the Maskilim reported them to the Russian government. Maskilim were the self-hating Jews that embraced a new world and wanted to cut any ties to Torah and religion, and so assimilated Jews, and they reported them to the authorities, and the authorities now clamped down on them, and the Tziv was forced to close the yeshiva, which was a great tragedy because Volozhin was the mother of all yeshivas, really the foundation of yeshiva world. And so after that happened, the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Berlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, said he wants to go to Eretz Yisrael. And he invited his Talmidim to join him. And 20 of his Talmidim joined him. and they traveled to Warsaw. Their plan was then to travel to Odessa and to get a ship through the Black Sea and to go to Eretz Yisrael, and I think via Turkey. And unfortunately, the Nativ had a stroke in Warsaw, and a few weeks later, he died in Warsaw. And that's when the Nativ is actually buried in this Jewish cemetery in Warsaw. He's buried next to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik over there. I've been to the Kfarim, which is very powerful and moving. And so the students didn't know what to do. Some of the students decided to go back to Lita, and some of the students decided to carry on and go to Eretz Yisrael. So amongst those students was Rabbi Wein's grandfather, Rabbi Chaim Zvi Rubinstein, and he decided to continue to Eretz Yisrael. And he first went to Yafo. A chavrusa of his, a study partner in Volozhin, was Rav Kook, and Rav Kook had a position in Yafo, and so Rav Kook helped him, and he opened the yeshiva in Yafo, and then he went to Yerushalayim, and he was approached by Rabbi Shmuel Salant and became one of the dayanim on Rabbi Shmuel Salant's Beis Din, which was obviously a great honor and a great privilege. And they lived in a place called Bate Machzeh. Bate Machzeh was a building complex in the Old City built by the Rothschilds in the late 19th century for those Jews returning to Eretz Yisrael. And that's where the Rubenstein stayed, and that's where Rabbi Wein's mother was born, in Bate Machzeh. He went to the United States to raise funds for the yeshuv, for the Jews that were in Eretz Yisrael, who were very poor at the time. And he was offered a position as a Rav in South Chicago when he was in the United States. And he accepted the position with his family, and he started a yeshiva in South Chicago. He's the Rav of the shul, and he also was a dayan in Chicago. So that's how his grandparents arrived, and his mother arrived at age 4. They arrived in Chicago, and his parents met, and they got married. And he then went to that yeshiva. Rabbi Wein went to the yeshiva that was founded by his grandfather early, from a young age, from age 10. And he was very much affected and influenced by his grandfather. His father, his grandmother passed away, and his grandfather moved in with them. And so he had his grandfather, his father, and his rabbonim in the yeshiva that he said had an indelible impact on his life. And his rabbonim were the famous Rabbi Mendel Kaplan, who was one of the rabbis in the yeshiva in Chicago, Rabbi Chaim Kreisworth, who was a great genius and also had a great influence on the Jewish world, one of his rabbis, and a rabbi of the name of Rabbi Rogoff. And Rabbi Wein speaks about he said he only realized much later in life, but when he thinks back, he saw that in that environment where he was, he really was in Lithuania, because all of these rabbonim had been in the great yeshivas of Lithuania, and they were now in Chicago, and they influenced his worldview tremendously. And he said, growing up, he thought that the world was a place that he saw in his rabbonim, a world of kindness, a world of holiness, a world of gentleness, a world of compassion, and a world of positivity. That's what he grew up in, and he thought the whole world was like that. But then he went to university to become a lawyer, and he realized that the world was completely different. He saw a cynical, selfish, negative world, which he said was quite a shocking experience for him. The reason why he decided to become a lawyer and to study law was because in the 1950s in the United States, certainly in Chicago, most of the Orthodox shuls were becoming conservative. And the sentiment was that there was no future for an Orthodox rabbi in the United States. And he certainly wasn't going to become a conservative rabbi. So he had come from a long line of rabbonim, both on his father's side and his mother's side. He also wanted to be a rabbi. He got smicha from the yeshiva in Chicago, but the family felt there was no future for him. And therefore, his father had in his shul a lawyer who said if he studies law, he'll give him articles, and so he decided to do so. He was a very smart person, Rabban, as I mentioned earlier, and therefore he did very well in his law studies, and he was a very successful lawyer. He got married, and his wife also came from a very rich stock of Torah heritage. His wife's father was Rabbi Levin, and Rabbi Levin was actually a Ben Bais by the Chofetz Chaim. His parents died, and his older sister took him to the house of Chofetz Chaim and said, "We orphans. He has my brother. Please, will you look after him?" And Chofetz Chaim took him in. He lived with the Chofetz Chaim for 2 years and studied Chofetz Chaim's yeshiva. And then they came to Detroit. He was a rabbi in Detroit. And Rawan's wife's name was Jackie, and they were married and lived in Chicago. And he practiced as a lawyer for a number of years. He became very successful as a lawyer. He had partners and bought a business. He was running the business. He was running his law office. And he had just built a new house. He had a fancy car. He was doing well. And then an old friend of his from Chicago Yeshiva, by the name of Rabbi Rottenberg, came to him. He was actually the founder of Mirkaz HaTorah in Jerusalem. He had been the rabbi in Miami Beach. And he said to Rabbi Wan, he's leaving, and he wants Rabbi Wan to take over his position. Rabbi Wan burst out laughing. He said, "What are you talking about?" And he actually said Rabbi Kreisverse, who was their joint rabbi, said that Rabbi Wan should replace him. So Rabbi Wan said, "There's just no way. I've just built a new house. I've just bought a new business. I ain't leaving Chicago. I've spent my whole life here. It's not going to happen." And Rabbi Rottenberg said to him, "Just allow me to apply for you for that position. And in fact, I'm not leaving until you agree to that." And so he said it was just before Thanksgiving. He was under a lot of pressure. He said, okay. And so he agreed. And he forgot about it. He didn't even tell his wife. He absolutely forgot about it. And that was in November. In May of 1964, he gets a call from the from the board of the shul in Miami Beach, and they said, "We believe you've applied for the position. We've now down to three candidates. You one of them. Please come for shvus." And he like suddenly remembered that conversation that he had a few months before. Went home and told his wife, and his wife said to him, "You know what? You're not happy." And he wasn't happy as a lawyer. He said because he saw the worst of people being a lawyer. You see the dark side of humans, unfortunately. She said, "You're not happy. And because you're not happy, I'm not happy. And because we're not happy, the children are not happy." His wife said, "You were cut out to be a Rav. Go, try it out. Let's see what happens." And so he, like a smart Jewish man, he listened to his wife and he went to Miami Beach. And he was appointed as the Rav, he said, by the overwhelming vote of 19 to 21. There was 21 in favor, 19 against, and he became the Rav in Miami Beach. So in a few months, they sold up everything, and they went to Miami Beach. And they were there for 8 years until 1972. He said it was an incredible experience. He said he learned the rabbinate over there. It started out as a small community of 39 families. He built it into a very large, thriving community. And he said one of the great things of being in Miami Beach was that he was exposed to many of the great rabbis of the generation. Because in America, during the winter, people migrated to Miami. And as a result of that, Ponovitch Arov would come to Miami. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky came to Miami. Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Satmar Rav. He became very close to all of them and also to Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. So he said he got a tremendous exposure to these great people, which absolutely changed his life, and being the Rav in Miami. In 1972, he was approached by the OU, the Orthodox Union, to come to New York and to be the executive vice president. And he signed a five-year contract and went to New York, and he became the head of OU Kashrus for 5 years. He said he was not an organizational man. He didn't enjoy being in a big organization, but that brought him to New York. And he became the Rav of Beis Torah, which is a shul in Suffern, New York. And he became the Rav there for the next 24 years. And when he left the OU in 1977, he founded Yeshiva Shaarei Torah of Rockland, which had a large high school and post-high school division. And he remained the Rosh Yeshiva of Shaarei Torah for the next 20 years until he made Aliyah in 1997. His son, Chaim Tzvi, succeeded him as the Rosh Yeshiva of Shaarei Torah. So in 1997, Rabbi Wan and his wife fulfilled their dream of making Aliyah, of going to Eretz Yisrael. And they had an apartment in Rehavia, and he became the Rav. He was off to be the Rav after being there for not a long time of the Beis Knesset HaNasi. HaNasi is the president. It's known as the president shul because the president is not far. And the president davened there. In fact, Rabbi Herzog, Yitzhak Herzog, who's the president of Israel, would often go to the shul, and he had a connection with the Rabbi Wan. He actually went to the Shiva house to comfort the family. I saw a video of it. In 1999, Rabbi Wan started the Destiny Foundation, and it was a platform through which he would market his shirim, his CDs, his tapes, his books, his movies, and it has had a tremendous impact on the Jewish people. In the 90s, Rabbi Wan was a great visionary, and he many Rabbonim were frightened of technology. He embraced technology, and if I often heard him say that Hashem created these things in order to be a platform through which to reach Jews and to teach Torah. And he was one of the first rabbis who recorded shiurim on tape in the 80s and disseminated them amongst the Jewish people, and he became very famous through that. Many people listened to his incredible history series, which was thousands of tapes going through Jewish history. And he was a fantastic speaker, really a witty, gifted orator. And he brought Jewish history to life and brought out such fascinating lessons and such interesting content. And his history series are still listened to by thousands. In fact, I saw on his website, on the Destiny website, Rabbi1.com, that over 1 million shirim have been purchased of Rabbi Wan's history series, which is quite unbelievable. And so he also then became the writer of many, many sforim and became very well known through his career in the Jewish world. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
So we're talking about Rabbi Wan and his tremendous contribution to the Jewish world. His tapes, his CDs, you could download them online, became very widespread within the Jewish people. He recorded, wrote down some of that highlights of that history series in four coffee table books spanning 2,300 years of Jewish history, Echoes of Glory, Herald of Destiny, Triumph of Survival, Faith and Fate is what they were called, those four books, which became bestsellers in the Jewish world. He's published over 18 books in English, 5 Sfarim in Hebrew. He produced 11 films, a classic on Rashi, on Rambam, on the Abarbanel, Faith and Fate, which was Jewish history, the different decades in Jewish history in the 20th century. Just phenomenal how prolific he was and how he was able to reach so many Jews. So let me just share with you a little bit about my personal relationship, personal reflections of my connection with Rabbi Wan. So I was learning in Eretz Yisrael. My wife and I were married in 1994, and we were privileged to learn in Eretz Yisrael, to live in Yerushalayim for 7 years after we were married. My parents very generously supported us to give us this incredible foundation and education. And I was learning in a place called Midrash Shmuel, which is in Shari Chesed in Jerusalem. Rabbi Wan lived not far away in Rehavia. And a good friend of mine by the name of Rabbi Brian Rubenstein, who now lives in London, he constantly badgered Rabbi Wan. Rabbi Wan was already a very well-known educator figure in the Jewish world. And my friend phoned him many, many times to say, my friend, I want to learn with you. My friend, I want to learn with you. I think Rabbi Wan was less painful to have to take his calls than to learn with us, you know. So we learned with him about probably every 2 weeks. Once every 2 weeks we went and to his apartment, and we learned Igeres HaRambam, the letters of the Rambam. The Rambam was a obviously, the Rambam of 1,000 years ago, Maimonides, was a great genius, a great thinker, had a tremendous perspective and understanding of Torah and of life as a Jew. Rabbi Wan absolutely loved the Rambam, and I think much of his worldview is very much in sync with the Rambam's perspective and balance. And a lot of that came through the letters that we learned with him. And then my wife and I were approached to join a community kollel in Sea Point in Cape Town, which had been started by Rabbi Schippel in the Awesome Mayor community in Sea Point. And Rabbi Wan was encouraging of me to go and join this community kollel. When we were in Cape Town, he came to visit Cape Town. He was brought out by Claremont Shul, by Rabbi Liebenberg. And I drove him and his wife around and arranged for them to give a shiur in Osameach. It was actually 2002, just after 9/11. I asked him to speak on Jews and Islam and the history of the Jewish people and Muslims. He gave this most incredible shiur, which was a panorama of history and the ups and downs. And it was just phenomenal. So I was driving him around the next day, showing them Cape Town and his wife. And I said, how do you know all that stuff? He said, I read a little bit. And his wife told me that, you know, they would go on holiday, the family. He would take 3 1,000-page books, and he would get through all of them on holiday. The kids would say, there's no way you got through those books. And he said, try me. And they would open up anywhere and test him, and he answered all their questions. So he was brilliant. He was photographic. He just really knew a tremendous amount about everything and very eloquently shared it. And at that time, they were looking for a rabbi at the Garden Shul, and Rabbi Wan encouraged me to apply for the position. I was reluctant and said, you know, it's a big community. It's the oldest community of Cape Town and one of the biggest communities in South Africa. I was a little bit intimidated, and he encouraged me and said I should do it. He said it'll be good for me and good for the Jewish people. And he wrote me a very strong letter of recommendation, and he said, don't worry, I'll help you, I'll guide you. And from that point, I really turned to him regularly for many questions that I had, being the rabbi of a large community. And we had our centenary, the Garden Shul. It was 100 years since the building of the beautiful building of the Garden Shul. And we brought him out as our keynote speaker. He stayed in the Mount Nelson. One of the congregants had a connection to Mount Nelson, so they arranged for him to stay there, and he loved it, you know, being a student of history, a historian. So he said it's one of the only places on the planet where the empire still lives on. They had high tea at 4 o'clock. He really enjoyed it. And I then became quite close to him from that point on. And there was a school, a religious school that had started in Cape Town, and the person who started the school then left Cape Town, and there was nobody else to take over. And this person wanted me to take over, and I said, I have no experience at running a school. I don't know anything about a school. And I asked Rabbi Wan, and he pushed me very hard. And he said, if you want to have an impact on Cape Town and build the city from a Jewish point of view, the school will be the way you do that. And he also guided me very closely in running of the school. We had to raise a lot of money and build a new campus, and there were those that wanted naming rights for the school, and he expertly led me through that whole very tricky process. And Baruch Hashem, we built a new campus in Camps Bay, and we established the Fuller's Joel Jewish Day School, which is still running and still successful in Cape Town. And much of that is because of Rabbi Wan's guidance and influence. He also encouraged my wife and I to take the position in Johannesburg at the Sunny Road community, Sunny Road Kehillah, which we did so in 2008, and he, again, was very encouraging and guided us through that process. And we brought him out a few times to Johannesburg, him and his wife, and we actually took them on safari twice. He absolutely loved the bush, Rabbi Wan, loved the bush, couldn't get enough of it. And he just wanted to go on game drives and be in the bush, and he really connected very deeply with the beauty of nature and the power of Hashem in the bush. And he enjoyed it very much. And always said, when we're going on safari, when you're taking me on safari. That was my personal connection to Rabbi Wan. And he then became my Rebbe and guided me throughout my life. And he was so astute and so sharp and so clear and had such an incredible perspective of life and of the Jewish people and of our function in this world. And he was such a great mentor for a rabbi. People call him the rabbi's rabbi. He actually wrote a book called Tending the Vineyard, which is a book for rabbis, one of his 18 books. And really, he was the, I was a great blessing for me to have been exposed to him and have been connected to him. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
So to end off, we discussed the portrait and personal reflections. Let's conclude with perspective. Rabbi Wein's perspective of life and the world was fueled by his love, his commitment, his passion for the Jewish people. And that really colored everything that he did and every person that he guided and advised. As I mentioned earlier, Rabbi Wein's father-in-law, Rabbi Levine, was a Talmud of the Chofetz Chaim. He became a rabbi in Detroit for many decades. And he told Rabbi Wein that when after he went out, after he received smicha and went out to become a rabbi in a community, he went to get a brocha from his Rebbe, the Chofetz Chaim. And the Chofetz Chaim told him, he said, go and speak to the Jewish people. And that was a mantra by which Rabbi Wein lived, that our responsibility as Rabbonim is to speak to the Jewish people, is to go out and connect with and have make sure one has access to and a dialogue and communicate with the Jewish people, share with the Jewish people what it means to be a Jew, what our heritage is, what our responsibility is, what our mission is in this world. And Rabbi Wein was a great genius at seeing situations in life and bringing them out with life lessons. I once asked him, how long does it take to you to prepare your droshes for Shabbos? I said, when do you start preparing your droshes for Shabbos? He said, I start the whole week. I'm preparing the whole week. Because he would see things and then he would mold them into a life lesson. So one of these life lessons was that when he made Aliyah and went to Eretz Yisrael, he had to take his license again, his driver's license in Israel. And he got it first time. And the instructor said to him, you're a good driver. Rabbi Wein said, why? He said, because I noticed you just looked in your rear view mirror. And a good driver is looking in the rear view mirror. Rabbi Wein said, a good Jew looks in the rear view mirror. Our problem is that as Jews, we're ignorant of our history. We don't know our past. We don't look in our rear view mirror. And I'm going to read you a quote of his. He used to say, the Jewish story is over 3,700 years old, and each of us is part of it. We aren't facing a single problem today that we haven't faced before. And if we study the past and learn its lessons, we'll be in a much better position to pull out towards our shared future. So he was very big on teaching Jews history, on understanding our history. And he said, if you know where you're coming from, you know where you're going. I'm going to share with you another quote of his from Mishpacha magazine from 3 years ago. So Rabbi Wein said, in my opinion, a lack of knowledge of Jewish history, a lack of attachment to the Jewish story is the greatest cause of secularization of the Jewish people today. Without knowing Jewish history, we know neither who we are nor where we are and where we are meant to be. So he was passionate about that, and he pushed the education of Jews to understand where we've come from and therefore to have a clear perspective of where we're going. And finally, we'll end off with one last teaching of his, which is he emphasized the importance of learning Nach, learning the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim. And he said, in the words of the prophets are every lesson that we need for all time for the Jewish people. For example, he says, right now, since October 7th, Eitz Tzara LeYaakov, it's a difficult time for the Jewish people. It's a very challenging time for the Jewish people. But if we look at Jewish history, we've always had challenging times. We've always had very difficult situations and circumstances. Such is the story of the Jewish people. But Rabbi Wein said, we learn from the prophets that it will be good, that it will end up good, that the Jewish people will achieve their purpose and fulfill their mission. And things will be positive and we will succeed in achieving what we're supposed to. And so we should be positive. And he always shared this message. Be positive about the Jewish people. Be positive about where we're going. And we ultimately will fulfill our purpose and our destiny. Thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful day.